Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
Hello, I'm Ivan Semenek in Boston.
And this is SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
This week on the May 26th edition of SciPod, Earth's Fiery Future, the surprising connection between global warming and geological disaster.
Let It Shine, what looking at the moon can reveal about conditions on Earth, and about other Earths too.
Human on its ship, what's the best way to find out if a drug has dangerous side effects? Why not try it out on your own working version of the human body in miniature?
Plus, in science news, are you a premature baby? Well, maybe what you need is a good cup of coffee. SciPod. It's not just a podcast, it's a science espresso.
It should come as no surprise that climate change is having an impact on weather patterns around the world. And there are also good reasons to believe that climate change is affecting ocean currents, too. But what might come as a surprise is the idea that climate change could go much deeper than that and produce geological consequences. This week, New Scientist takes a closer look at what could be Earth's fiery future.
For years, climate change seemed like a distant threat, but lately evidence is mounting that changes are already well underway, and that change is not just in the air, it could be in the Earth itself.
As we study the Earth as a whole system, and as we look back particularly over the last ice age when there were huge changes in climate, we're realising that the geosphere, in other words the rocks beneath our feet and the atmosphere and what we call the hydrosphere, are all related. They all interact in different complicated ways, and so you can't make drastic changes in one without affecting the others.
Bill Maguire is a geophysicist at the Benfield Hazard Research Centre in London. As he explains it, one crucial way in which the climate interacts with the Earth's crust is through the movements of vast quantities of water. The numbers are sobering. A cubic metre of water weighs 1 metric tonne. A cubic metre of ice weighs nearly as much. And when an entire ice sheet that weighs trillions of tonnes starts to melt away, Maguire says we should expect the Earth to react.
So you're moving huge amounts of mass around the planet, and that can affect the planet in all sorts of different ways. It can affect the rate at which the planet spins, it can affect its rotation, it can also stress and strain particularly the margins of the continents.
Maguire cites Greenland as a potential geophysical hazard linked to climate change. Greenland is both an island and a mini-continent that happens to be covered in ice. When global warming causes the ice to melt, Greenland could become the geological equivalent of a restless giant waking up from a deep slumber.
Greenland has an ice sheet which is up to 3 kilometres thick, and it's pushing down the underlying crust, almost to sea level, even in the interior. Now, when that ice melts, and it certainly looks with the way things are going as if the Greenland ice sheet is virtually lost to us, once that happens, the crust is going to bounce back up again at a relatively rapid rate. And as it does so, it will almost certainly trigger the activation of faults. It will trigger earthquakes around the margins of the continent. What that can do, because people aren't going to be too bothered about the earthquakes, there aren't a great deal of people living around the area, but what it can do is it can the quakes themselves can trigger big submarine landslides. There's a huge amount of sediment, glacial sediment, piled up around the continent there. So these earthquakes could trigger giant landslides. They could trigger big tsunami that could affect the North Atlantic region.
It's happened before, most recently when vast ice sheets disappeared from Europe and North America at the end of the last ice age. There are hints that Earth didn't take this change lying down. It was the departure of ice age glaciers from Scandinavia, for example, that triggered a massive earthquake off the coast of Norway 8,000 years ago, sending a 20-metre-high wall of water over the Shetland Islands. But could global warming really trigger a similar event? In fact, there's evidence that it already has. In Alaska, scientists have noticed an increase in the number of minor earthquakes along some of the more active faults.
This is exactly what you'd expect. If you unload the crust and you have active faults in the region, then those faults will be able to move more easily. One of the big concerns, obviously, is that Alaska has some of has the potential to generate some of the biggest earthquakes around.
A major underwater earthquake near Alaska could send a tsunami around the entire Pacific Rim. And in the same part of the world, a different sort of geological threat is also brewing.
Yeah, well, Alaska and across the water there, the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia, are two of the most volcanically active parts of the planet. There are lots of volcanoes there. One of them in particular, Pavlov, seems to be extremely sensitive to the changes in sea level. Now, when the winter storms cross it, sea level rises by maybe 30 centimetres or so, as the atmospheric pressure is lower, and that seems to be able to trigger eruptions. So that's obviously a volcano that's critically poised so that a small change in sea level can set it off. What I'm most concerned about is maybe the sea level rises of 1 to 2 metres this century and several more next century, and the impact those can have on volcanoes right across the planet.
The connections between global warming and volcanoes is not as unlikely as it sounds. Maguire and his colleagues have already found evidence that suggests it's a well-established pattern. Their investigation of deep core samples from the Mediterranean Sea links ancient layers of volcanic ash with changes in sea level worldwide.
And it looks as if there were more explosive volcanic eruptions which produced these ash layers when sea level was going up quickly or coming down quickly. It wasn't the absolute measure of sea level or the height of sea level, it was how quickly it was moving. And this isn't really surprising, I suppose, because if you can imagine magma sitting in the volcano ready to erupt, you need a dynamic situation. You need to be changing the stress field within that volcano or the strain within that volcano till it comes to a particular critical point and then it goes bang.
And speaking of things that go bang, what worries Maguire is that these natural trends in volcanic activity could be accelerated by rapid sea level changes due to global warming.
We may be seeing in the next couple of hundred years the effect that we picked up in the Mediterranean volcanoes over the last 10,000 years. Something like 57% of all the world's volcanoes form islands or sit on coasts, and nearly all the others are within 250 kilometres of a coast. So if we have a big rise in sea level, if we change the stress and strain in those continental margins, in those island volcanoes, we could see many more volcanic eruptions than we do now. It shouldn't surprise people, because it's just yet another consequence of meddling with the Earth's climate, this great experiment we're undertaking. And given that the hydrosphere, the geosphere, the climate, the atmosphere are all incredibly interlinked, this shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody.
Maguire and his colleagues are now looking at how the melting of the ice sheets in western Antarctica and Greenland are likely to affect volcanic activity through a rapid rise in sea level. If they're right, then climate change does indeed come with geological consequences, and that means Earth will have a fiery future in the decades ahead.
And you can find out more about Bill Maguire's research and the geological consequences of global warming in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine.
SciPod, an audio service of New Scientist magazine.
Still on the subject of climate change. This week, scientists were feeling reflective about how to better understand what climate change is doing to the Earth's atmosphere. Reflective because crucial information about Earth's climate is reflected back to us after bouncing off the moon. Astronomers call this effect Earthshine, and it not only reveals something about life on our planet, it may actually help us find life elsewhere in the universe. Dr. Phil Goody has seen more Earthshine than most. We spoke to him this week at the Joint Assembly of the American Geophysical Union in Baltimore, where he chaired a session on the subject.
Dr. Goody, how does one go about seeing Earthshine? What is the phenomenon we're talking about here?
Well, Earthshine was first explained by Leonardo da Vinci, and it's sunlight that's reflected from the Earth to the moon and then back to the nighttime observer. It's what enables you to see the full moon at a quarter moon, and you see the other three quarters illuminated in this sort of ghostly haze.
Right, so it's that lovely image of the old moon and the young moon's arms, I guess, when you have the bright crescent, but the dim outline of the rest of the moon is visible as well.
Right.
Now, it's certainly convenient that the moon is there to act as a mirror to Earth's light. What is that reflected Earth light telling you about the state of the planet?
Well, by looking and comparing the light from the Earthshine, the dark side, and the bright side, the moonshine, we can get an absolutely calibrated measure of the Earth's reflectance. So, for instance, at a quarter moon, if you were on the moon, you would see a three-quarters Earth, and the Earthshine would be telling you how much sunlight there is being reflected from that three-quarters Earth.
And Dr. Goody, what is the significance of what you are seeing with that Earthshine?
Well, the Earth reflects about 30% of the sunlight, and if that were to change from, say, 30% to 29%, then you would have a change in the Earth's energy balance, which would be somewhat larger than contributed by all of the greenhouse gases that have been added since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So that's a 1% change in the Earth's reflectance, and that's the kind of effect we see. Through the 1980s, there was a decline in the Earth's reflectance, more sunlight reaching us, and then beginning in 2000, that's reversed.
So first of all, that's quite a significant implication that even a small change in Earth's shine can mean big changes to Earth's energy budget. Why do you think it has been changing or sort of inverting in this way in the time that you've been watching?
Well, we know that it's a change in the properties of the clouds, but what's causing that, we don't know. It would seem to be some kind of natural phenomenon. I mean, you could imagine, for instance, that as the greenhouse gases were growing through the 1980s and 1990s, that somehow that might, by some unknown mechanism, feed back and cause the clouds to change so that there's more sunlight. But then when it reverses, you can't cause the clouds to decline and then to increase again. So it's some kind of natural cycle. And I think most people acknowledge that when it comes to climate change, there are a lot of natural cycles that we don't fully understand, and this kind of change is not accounted for in the climate models. On the other side of it, it doesn't mean that this is going to have a huge effect on climate. It may turn out that it averages out to nothing, but on the other side, until we know that and until we understand the origin of it, we can't be sure what the implications are for climate change.
Now, you are interested in developing a global network to make these kinds of observations. Why is it important to see Earth shine from different places and times?
Well, for instance, from California, we see very well Southeast Asia all the way west to the Urals and Africa and South America, but we don't see the United States. So if you had a station in South Africa or India, they could see the United States, so it would be an excellent complement and give us global coverage as well as redundant coverage.
I see. So in other words, when you're looking at Earth light reflected from the moon, of course, it has to be, I assume it's the evening that you're watching this, so you're in the dark, but you're actually watching sunlight reflecting off of a daylight side of the Earth, which is not where you are.
Right. And so when the sunlight is reflecting off of the United States, then we can't see the Earth shine, so we can't measure that.
So what would the ideal global network look like? How many telescopes would you want, and how would they be distributed around the world?
Well, we would like to have six of them, and sort of 60 degrees apart around the world. But it would be advantageous to have northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere coverage. So, you know, you could have a station in the Canary Islands and almost at the same longitude in South Africa, but they would cover different parts of the world.
Now, Dr. Goody, I just can't let you go without a question about the search for life on other worlds. I know that's also a topic under discussion at the conference you're attending this week. Can you fill us in on how Earthshine might play a role in the search for ET?
Well, I'll try. When you look at the Earthshine, as you see it when you look at the moon, you can't resolve any continents or anything on the Earth. So you're looking at the Earth as though it were a star. So it gives you some insight, imagine that you're an astronomer in a distant star system and you're trying to discover the Earth. What are the conditions under which you could discover the Earth? And that's what we explored.
So in other words, you're getting your practice by looking at Earth shining off the moon as to how to interpret light that may one day be seen from other Earth-like planets around other stars.
Right. And, you know, when you study the Earth shine, you learn things that you wouldn't have thought of, but they're directly applicable to how you build the instruments and what the problems are going to be when you're looking for Earth-like planets around other stars.
Well, thanks, Dr. Goody, for telling us about this, and good luck with your research.
Well, thank you very much.
Dr. Phil Goody is an astronomer and director of the Big Bear Solar Observatory in California. We reached him in Baltimore. And now it's time for this week's science news. A shot of caffeine may be your preferred way to start the day, but for premature babies, it could also save their life. Researchers at the University of Toronto in Canada have discovered that a dose of caffeine given to babies born after just 27 weeks of pregnancy helps protect them from lung damage. Premature babies are typically placed in artificial respirators as soon as they're born, but the pressure from these machines means that babies risk developing a lung disease called bronchopulmonary dysplasia. In a study of 2,000 premature babies, researchers found that caffeine appears to lower the baby's risk of getting the disease from 47 to 36%. Doctors have long prescribed caffeine to premature babies because it helps protect against apnea, a condition in which the babies repeatedly stop breathing. Size does matter, no matter what species you are. Whether it's the antlers of a deer or a peacock's feathery display, the special body parts that males of many species use to attract females tend to be disproportionately large. Now researchers at the University of New Mexico have shown that this tendency may be universal. In what is the largest such study to date, the group studied the relative sizes of sexual ornaments for 284 species. In virtually every case, they found that an increase in body size meant an even greater increase in the size of the male's ornaments. Scientists say devoting so much energy and nutrients to growing these ornaments makes good evolutionary sense. They're the most conspicuous way to advertise reproductive fitness to females. And finally, popping pills may not be good for your health, even if those pills are vitamins. 50% of Americans take vitamin supplements regularly, but a new study from the US National Institutes of Medicine casts doubt on whether vitamin supplements actually make healthy people healthier. In fact, taking vitamins can sometimes do damage. For example, people taking vitamin D and calcium supplements can increase their risk of kidney stones, and smokers who take beta-carotene to protect against lung cancer might actually increase their cancer risk. As for the presumed benefits of taking vitamin supplements, the study claims the evidence just isn't there. In fact, it may be that the biggest impact vitamin supplements have is on the health of your wallet.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod. As you can probably tell, we're trying out a new sound this week, a sound that was largely inspired by all the helpful feedback and ideas you've been sending to us over the past 6 months. I know we haven't really talked about this up till now, but we have been very grateful for your input, and we would love to know what you think about this week's show. We want to be your science podcast, so if you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. It's easy, just email your feedback to podcast@newscientist.com. And on behalf of everyone who's worked to keep SciPod growing and improving over these months, thank you for lending us your ears. Now, back to SciPod.
2 years ago, Vioxx was among the best-selling drugs in the world, earning billions of dollars in sales. Then came the revelation that Vioxx apparently doubles the risk of heart attacks in long-term users, and in no time it was off the shelves for good. Vioxx may be an extreme case, but it's an example of a larger problem. Despite all the money and testing that goes into drug development, some drugs that shouldn't get to market still do. Dr. Michael Schuller has a novel way around this problem. He's a biomedical engineer, and he's been busy building a miniature version of the human body, including a liver, kidneys, lungs, and more, all on a tiny silicon chip. We reached him at his lab in Cornell University.
Dr. Schuller, I'm very intrigued with this idea of recreating the human body in miniature. How does one go about doing that on a small chip?
Well, we can fabricate a system which takes certain components of the body, makes them into little compartments, in those compartments, which we treat like little microreactors, we put cells representing the particular metabolism of that tissue, for example, the liver, lung, kidney, fat, or a cancer cell, whatever it might be. And that represents some of the key capabilities of that that tissue. We interconnect these compartments by the way the blood flows in the body. For example, if 23% of the arterial blood in the body goes into the liver, we would model that. If 5% goes in the fat, we model that. So we have the fluid recirculating. As it would recirculate in the body, we have an external pump that acts more or less like the heart to make sure that recirculation occurs. And the tissues then exchange nutrients in the same way and metabolites, products of the reactions, the same way they would in the human body.
That's amazing. So I'm picturing all of these compartments, one for the liver, one for the kidneys, and so on. What does it actually look like on the lab bench?
Well, what we've been doing is we've been building these systems on a little chip about 1 inch by 1 inch. We made the chip out of silicon using the same kinds of techniques people have used to alter chips, for example, in the electronics industry. And we mount that chip in a little plastic housing that we can see through. And most of our work so far has been looking at the response under a microscope. We look for certain dyes that will indicate to us the depletion of a nutrient or accumulation of a reactant that we put in the system, like a cancer drug, or something to do with the viability of the cell, how if the cell is alive or not.
And just so I'm clear on this, when we talk about all of these compartments connected together on this chip, at the core of each is some human tissue, is that right?
Yes, most of the compartments. We do have some compartments in which we would not expect any reactions to occur or any absorption of any of the compounds to occur. They're there without cells, and that represents a holdup of the blood in that tissue in the body, so we get the time-dependent change in concentration right, the dynamics right.
And so what does having cells in this kind of environment linked up together so it simulates the body, what can that do for you that you wouldn't be able to do, say, just by culturing those cells in a standard way?
Well, one of the things we're looking at is many drugs or environmental chemicals that you're exposed to is not the parent compound that you are react to, but it's metabolites that are formed by reaction in certain tissues that is what you react to. So we're combining tissues which have metabolic activity, which form these products, with other tissues which might be recipients of those products. It's also a little bit more complex because some of these other tissues will make, in response to exposure to that byproduct reaction, another product which will alter the rate of reaction. So we have this exchange of compounds between all these different tissues. If we cultured each of these tissues by themselves, we would never see this kind of exchange of chemicals and the information they represent.
And how did you evolve toward this? I imagine you can't just reconstruct a human being overnight. What led you in this direction?
Well, we were interested in really making a contribution to understanding how the human body found certain chemicals toxic or not toxic. I was also interested in the response if one had altered the genetic composition of cells in the body. I have a daughter who has Down syndrome, for example, and she has an extra chromosome, and that was one of our initial motivations. We made use of a mathematical modeling technique that had been developed 40 years ago, which laid out a map or a diagram for the body and how to interconnect the compartments, but you can't have full faith in that model because you don't know if you've included all the relevant capabilities of the cells. So by adding the cells, we now add those capabilities which we might not normally be aware of. So we took what was a mathematical concept and made it a physical reality.
And as you say, you're still in the process of developing this technique, but how close do you imagine you'll be able to get to modeling the function of a real human system?
Well, there's we've devised a system to answer relatively specific questions. In those cases, we're confident. For example, we're interested in multi-drug resistant cancer. That's a cancer that forms if you're have cancer, you treat it with a chemotherapeutic agent. Many times the cancer disappears, but then it may reappear 2 or 3 years later and be resistant to the chemotherapeutic agent or drug you were given, and many other related drugs. And people have thought about a combination of treatment with drugs and compounds which suppress, for example, a pump protein that these multi-drug-resistant proteins might have in abundance, looking for combinations which might open up a therapeutic window to treat that cancer. And we can do that in this system. We've been doing some studies with the combination compounds using a metabolite, a liver cell line which makes metabolites, a bone marrow cell line which represents response to normal tissue, and two different cancer cell lines, which a normally sensitive cancer cell line and one which is multi-drug resistant. And using that system, we can actually decide if the combination drugs we're using might have some potential for use in humans.
And I guess there's another dimension to this, which is if this system is effective as a way of modeling how a human body will respond to different treatments, different drugs, does that then lessen the need for animal testing? Are we moving toward a future with less animal testing?
Yes, that's our hope. And we can build these systems both with animal cells and human cells. So we like to reduce the dependency on animal tests, and use animal tests only under those conditions where we're most likely to get an interesting response. And also, by using human cells, we help in extrapolating animal data to prediction what happens in humans, because we can build it with both human and animal cells. And that's something that's been missing in the past. That's part of the reason now why drugs cost as much as they do. Only 1 in 10 drugs which enters these human clinical trials, which are extremely expensive, ever comes out as a product. If we can choose better those products most likely to be successful before we begin those trials, we can save a lot of money and reduce the cost of drugs, and that should have a societal benefit as well.
Well, it's really quite a revolution. Thanks very much for this, Dr. Schuller.
Well, thank you and goodbye.
Dr. Michael Schuller spoke to us from his lab at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He's one of the researchers featured in a story about creating a human on a chip. And you can find that in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine. And that's it for this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the May 27th issue of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, the kink at the edge of the solar system. New evidence from NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft suggests our solar system is taking an electromagnetic beating that's leaving it pushed in on one side.
Rethinking BSE. It's well known that mad cow disease can be contracted by eating the brain tissue of infected animals. But then how do similar diseases get spread among herds of sheep or elk that just graze on grass? A new study may have solved the mystery.
And, smarter than the average bug, the Portia genus of jumping spider reveals cognitive skills that are supposed to be way beyond such tiny creatures, leaving animal researchers wondering if they may have an inkling of a mind.
This week's edition of SciPod was brought to you by the staff and contributors of New Scientist magazine and NewScientist.com, which this week included Patrick Berry, Claire Bowles, Rowan Hooper, Michael LePage, and Robin Orwant. Our technical production is by Bill Oxley, and our theme music was created and performed by The Damn Neighbors.
John McFarlane is the executive producer of SciPod. I'm Caroline Williams.
And I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.